This last was the true giveaway, and McLean did not miss it, for he was an intensely shrewd man who, even in his early 20s, had stored up allies. Many people owed him favours, even their lives. So, at that moment, McLean decided to put veracity to the test. Not that he was prepared to start asking the imponderable questions just yet. Richardson, on the other hand, did not shirk from probing. You could possibly help. He looked up with bright, intelligent eyes that Jim was later to think of as Ratty's eyes from The Wind in the Willows. Perhaps, as a solicitor, you could work out some foolproof way such a man could get paid. That'd be the real trick, how to commission him and pay him without beating a path to his door. Ah, yes. Already, electric patterns were activating Jimmy McLean's brain. Eventually, he said, It has to be part of the illusion of life. To do what you propose, one would have to construct two visible worlds, like a set of Chinese boxes, or a mirror cabinet which looks empty but is really secretly full of all kinds of stuff. From there, the solicitor outlined the bare bones of a plan that was the first step toward the structure they later manipulated with such success. The brilliant scheme that allowed complete control over anyone who approached the system used by Alchemist's support organization. It was almost 18 months before the two men, the killer soldier and the lawyer, came together again. By that time, McLean had devised the unbeatable system and already knew where to put the necessary surveillance hardware and software. The radios, scanners, cell phones, scramblers, voice-distorting mics, automatic telephone exchanges, recorders, night vision glasses, infrared and thermal imaging gizmos, and the rest of the ultra-gee-whiz gear so necessary for Alchemist's success. McLean's initial investment was in time and a relatively small amount of money. During that first conversation, as he listened to Richardson explain the plot of his book, McLean felt the hair rise on the nape of his neck. At that point, he made certain that the man he had met by chance knew how to get in touch with him again. He was 99% certain that his own life probably depended on doing business with this tough, coiled spring of a man. Once this professional killing machine was set in motion, McLean reasoned, all traces of preparation, such as the Savoy conversation, would be wiped from the slate by gun, knife, poison, or bludgeon, unless both parties were engaged in work for the future, becoming mutually dependent. During that first casual meeting, Richardson baited the trap, then reappeared one July evening in Dublin with a telephone call and a You won't remember me, line of chat that sent McLean off twitchy to dinner in the wilds of County Wicklow. There, over gazpacho, grilled sole and summer pudding, the assassin-elect came clean, and the solicitor told him he'd known all the time. So it began, and almost by design, Alchemist's first clients were one of the wealthier offshoots of the Provisional Irish Republican Army. These paying customers asked for the deaths of a senior Royal Ulster Constabulary officer and an SAS Lieutenant Colonel. These men had been under a death sentence for months, yet had eluded several assassination attempts. Experts had tried to bomb and shoot them, yet, perpetually ringed with steel, they'd seemed to live charmed lives. Both killings had to be unattributable to the principals, and by this time Richardson had made up his mind how he was going to signal his own presence. By the coup de grace shot to the back of the head, and the Shakespearean quotation on the body. Originally, he'd planned for this item to be in the victim's pocket. But haste in the first killing had determined a tiny deviation. Oddly, the first murders had similar aspects during the opening phases. Early in his planning, Richardson had found foolproof ways to crack into the supposed secure telephone system of both the RUC and the British Army. So certain of their own safe communications were those two organizations that they'd long ceased to take simple precautions when using the screened phones. Both the RUC superintendent and the SAS lieutenant colonel had a similar Achilles heel, women, or at least one woman each. Both men were married, and their dangerous liaisons were carried out by using police and military safe houses, claiming that the women were informers. So it was relatively easy for Richardson to listen to the secret and somewhat licentious telephone conversations between the men and their lovers, eventually turning plans to his own advantage. In essence, he used an identical modus operandi in both cases. He hid within the agreed meeting places, hours in advance of the times the lovers had arranged to meet, then telephoned the woman, almost at the last minute, using a code word to call off the assignation. In both cases, the men had walked straight into the entrapment, almost with their cocks in their hands, as Richardson later told Tess, who in a bizarre way had become fascinated by the mechanics of murder, and had been dispatched by bullets fired from the silent Smith & Wesson revolver. Nowadays there's so much publicity for H&Ks, 9mm and even 12mm automatics, that the ancient good revolver seems outdated, Richardson said. Alchemist's escape had been made good by some clever misdirection, a small explosion in the case of the superintendent, and shots from a well-contrived booby trap operated by remote control. The trigger on an elderly Stirling submachine gun, activated by the kind of device used to fly model airplanes. In the ensuing commotion, Richardson had got away, while in the aftermath the full truth was never revealed by those close to each of the two men. Both had exceptionally loyal cohorts, and that did not hurt Alchemist's reputation. Hence the word of mouth that allowed him to walk through walls. As for the relationship between Richardson and McLean, during and following the first two killings, it had been all downhill and a matter of trust. Now, several years later, they corresponded only through Tessa Murray, who carried detailed letters in her head from Dublin or London to Switzerland. Ronald Brinsley Richardson now lived in simple luxury in a pink villa hard by the water's edge, with its own little boathouse and a garden sloping down to a small private beach in the town of Brissago, just on the Swiss side of Lake Maggiore. After her meeting with Jimmy McLean and their conversation in the Wicklow Gap, Tessa Murray headed for Switzerland, followed by Bex Oleska and another friendly watcher, plus an unseen wraith of a person whom neither of them knew was also there until almost too late.